Okay.
Hey guys. Sorry about the weird cut, but we decided to split this episode up into several different parts. So we're just popping in to let you know that that's what's going on.
You can expect the third part of this episode in about 2 weeks.
See ya.
Bye.
So I think what I'd like to do now is talk about Ludlow and some of the lead up to it. Since we started in Colorado, I think it would probably be best if we stayed in Colorado for a bit. And then we can get to West Virginia, if that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now we come to the podcast where I'm going to talk a lot. we are going to be discussing the Ludlow Massacre. Let me just check my notes real quick. I want to see if Colorado was a Union state. So Colorado was not a state with a strong Union presence in the time of like 1913 to 1914, which was when the Ludlow Massacre happened. So the background for Ludlow is that there were rich coal veins in Ludlow, Colorado, which caught the attention of this guy named William Jackson Palmer, who was surveying land for the Kansas Pacific Railway. In 1910, the coal mining industry of Colorado employed 15,864 people, or 10% of all of the labor in the state. So they were a just massive like powerhouse. They composed 10% of the entire labor market of Colorado. So like 1 in 10 people was a coal miner. So there was the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, and John D. Rockefeller purchased a huge stake in it. So he would become very instrumental in this story, as one of the guys, like, basically, like, behind the scenes, oppressing the coal miners. I found in my research that there were 8 deaths per 1,000 miners in Ludlow compared to the national rate of 4 per 1,000. So conditions there were particularly bad in the mines. In 1914, the United States House Committee on Mines and Mining reported that Colorado has good mining laws and such that ought to afford the protection of the miners as to safety in the mine if they were enforced. Yet in this state, the percentage of fatalities is larger than any other, showing there is undoubtedly something wrong in reference to the management of the coal mines. This was also another instance in which the miners were living under company towns, which we've already gone into detail about. So basically, their entire lives belonged to the company. The historian Philip S. Foner described company towns as feudal domains, with the company acting as lord and master. The law consisted of the company rules, curfews were imposed, company guards, brutal thugs armed with machine guns and rifles loaded with soft point bullets, basically grenades, would not admit any suspicious stranger into the camp and would not permit any miner to leave. This was an area that was unorganized. And this is important because organized mines boasted 40% fewer fatalities than the non-union mines. And eventually, like the miners started trying to unionize. So the mine operators would hire strike breakers mainly from Mexico and southern and eastern Europe. They would mix immigrants of different nationalities together to prevent communication between them, which might lead to organization. And so, like, the union was trying to organize the people in Ludlow. So
Also, I think I would also like to point out, though, that would had to have made for more dangers in working in the mines as well. I mean, being able to communicate quickly with your coworkers is something that's vital in workplaces like that. So it sounds like they were willing to accept an even higher level of inherent danger for their workers, just despite these strikers.
yeah, absolutely. So eventually, the union presented a list of 7 demands. They wanted recognition of the union as a bargaining agent because they had not been recognized by the coal companies yet, Colorado Fuel and Iron. They wanted compensation for digging coal at a ton rate based on 2,000 pounds. Previous ton rates were of long tons of 2,200 pounds, which was more dangerous for them to mine and also made more work for themselves in order to get paid because they were paid by the ton. They wanted the enforcement of the 8-hour workday. They wanted payment for dead work, such as laying track, timbering, and handling impurities. So basically, like, if your house needed a new roof, like, guys would go in and do that, but they weren't compensated at all for it. And that was considered, like, dead work. They wanted wage checkmen elected by the workers to keep company wage men honest. So they wanted members of their own, like, body of laborers, like, serving to check the weight of the coal at the end of the day. They wanted their own people weighing the coal so they wouldn't cheat them out of what they were producing. They wanted the right to use any store and to choose their boarding houses and doctors, and they wanted strict enforcement of Colorado's laws, such as mine safety rules, abolition of scrip, and an end to the company guard system. These were all rejected by the Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation. They, once again, they gave them a phone and told them to call somebody who cared. So the Ludlow Miners decided to go on strike. And here is the part where I want to talk about a little bit of the context surrounding Colorado and the Colorado National Guard, which was eventually called in to break this strike. So according to The Road to Ludlow, Breaking the 1913-14 Southern Colorado Coal Strike by DeStefanis A.R., the Colorado National Guard had long-standing connections to Colorado's mining industry. These ties helped make the Guard the industry's ally when it faced a strike. Sherman Bell, who had been one of Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders in Cuba during the Spanish-American War, worked as a manager for two mining companies in Colorado's metal mining district before he became the Guard's adjutant general in 1903. Many observers believe that Colorado's metal mining companies backed Republican candidate James Peabody's 1902 campaign for governor after he pledged to use the National Guard against the Western Federation of Miners once he gained office. The metal mining companies were eager to destroy the militant WFM, which had mounted a successful strike in 1894 and had become the state's most powerful labor union. Shortly after the election, Peabody appointed managers and officials of the state's metal mining companies to the state military board and as aides-de-camp to the National Guard. Some newspapers also reported that mine operators were pressuring him to allow them to name the Guard's next adjutant general. When the WFM went on strike in Cripple Creek, Colorado, and elsewhere in 1903, Peabody gave the mine operators what they wanted by appointing Sherman Bell to the position of adjutant general. The Smith Moffat Mining Company, one of the largest metal mining outfits in Colorado and Bell's employers, wanted to destroy the WFM, but Bell's income would shrink from $5,000 to $1,800 a year if he left the company to take the job as adjutant general. Bell's quick acceptance of the position fueled speculation that metal mine owners had promised Bell the $3,200 he would lose by switching jobs. Once ensconced in his new position, Bell went about the work of eliminating the WFM. He declared that he came to do up this anarchistic federation, and publicly announced that he wanted to kill and exterminate the WFM. Bell had help in achieving these goals from his protege, John Chase. And John Chase would be the man who would go on to oversee the Ludlow Massacre. Now, the Ludlow Massacre has a lot of context. It is kind of a long history, as you can probably gather by the fact that I was just reading about stuff that happened in 1902, even though we're talking about something that happened in 1914. But yeah, there's a lot of context, and I'm going to try to cover that the best I can. Another quote that I'd like to read from The Road to Ludlow is that the Colorado legislature formed their state's state militia shortly after the nationwide 1877 railroad strike, when state officials and business leaders created the National Guards to have a strike-breaking force on hand capable of crushing the labor unrest that many believed would become more common after the 1877 strike. Over the next 50 years, the Colorado National Guard was called out on duty 23 times. 17 of those call-outs brought the Guard onto a strike situation, where it almost always acted to break the strike. So we see state officials being bought out. We see representatives from the coal company lying the state military boards and basically picking the guy who would lead the National Guard. And we see the actual creation of the Colorado State National Guard as specifically a strike-breaking force.
How much you want to bet, like, 95% of the people living in Colorado have no idea that that was the origin story for their state's National Guard?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't know it before I did some research into this. So yeah, that's the context in which we find ourselves. Everything is essentially stacked against these people. And after the Ludlow miners submit their demands to the coal companies and the coal companies rejected them, they decide to go on strike. So these miners, as we're going to see over and over again, were evicted from their homes and forced into a tent village provided by the union. Baldwin Feltz, which was a private detective agency, which I'm going to go over in just a second, was hired by the coal operators to shoot into the tents, killing people at random. They had a car called the Death Special, which was a car with a mounted machine gun. And sniper activity from them was so heavy that the miners were forced to dig holes in the tents for cover. They were really fucking bad, and I think it would be fun real quick to just kind of go over who these guys were, because they were fucking goobers. They were literally nerds. They were dweebs. They were dorks. I want to bully them. I want to swirly their fucking heads.
They were like the worst kind of LARPers.
They are the worst kind of LARPers.
Yeah.
William Gibney Baldwin was this guy who was born in Tazewell County, Virginia. He read a bunch of detective novels in his youth and was a big fan of the genre. And then when he got older, he owned a small business. He was studying to be a dentist, but that wasn't quite violent enough for him, so he decided to become a detective. With literally no prior experience whatsoever, this guy just decided to become a private detective. And in his early career, he would, like in the 1890s, give armed guards to the coal companies. Not a lot is known about this period in their history, which is a ginormous fucking red flag. I'm assuming a lot of documents were destroyed. But yeah, that was basically what he did. Then you had Thomas Lafayette Feltz, who was also a native of Virginia. He was educated as a lawyer and was a member of the Virginia Bar Association. And he joined up with the Baldwin Feltz Detective Agency, or at the time just the Baldwin Detective Agency, to give legal advice to the guards so they could, like, better crack skulls within the confines of the law. Like, this guy was basically just trying to help them get away with as much stuff as they possibly could get away with. This detective agency rose to national prominence in the high-profile case of Floyd Allen, but we don't really care about that, and we're going to pick up in the 1910s. So, by the 1910s, railroad robberies had decreased, and Baldwin Feltz began to almost exclusively rent out personal guards for the railroad companies. Local law enforcement wasn't able to do anything about it because decisions like those were left up to the companies who owned the town. And here I have a little quote about them. Baldwin Feltz was allowed to maintain such operations because public law enforcement and the maintenance of order and labor disputes were often left to company owners. Therefore, they could employ the likes of Baldwin Feltz to suppress strikes, collect intelligence on unions, prevent labor organizers from entering company grounds, and evict the families of union members living in company-owned housing who had gone on strike or failed to pay rent. That is from strike breaking in West Virginia at the Pocahontas coal fields and the Paint Creek Cabin Creek. Oh wait, that's a separate note I had. I actually don't have that quote attributed to anybody.
Oh, no worries. It's amazing how much autonomy these companies had.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, when people here talk about, oh, they want more deregulation, they want more deregulation, get the government out of business. Well, this is what that looks like.
Yeah. They were essentially able to act as governments.
Right.
Yeah.
This is what it looks like when companies are allowed to act with that level of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
This is why
we laugh at ANCAPs.
Yes.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, because this is what anarcho-capitalism looks like. This is what capitalism looks like when it doesn't have any restraints.
Yeah. Because what consequences did those coal barons face for all of the stuff that they did at Cripple Creek, you know? I mean,
oh, not Nothing.
No, the coal barons faced none.
Yeah, and so, that was a case of Ludlow, that was a case of Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, and that was a case of Blair Mountain.
You know, and not only that, but their crimes have been all but expunged from history.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this stuff is there. It's there to see, but you have to dig for it now.
Yeah. Also, fun fact, Baldwin and Feltz both became private bankers after retiring from the detective industry. So they used their capital well, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, back to the National Guard. So, here's a fun little fact. Many Baldwin Feltz operatives and hired guns for the coal operators were absorbed back into the National Guard because they were literally just that desperate for state militiamen. These armed guardsmen dissuaded immigrant scabs from leaving their jobs, and if you look into what the National Guard was actually doing in the days leading up to the Ludlow Massacre, is not pretty. The document I read, The Road to Ludlow, documents 34 instances of the National Guard intimidating strikers. I read stories about the National Guard essentially tricking miners into thinking that they were digging their own shallow graves. And then...
Oh, yeah. We'll have to talk about Andrew Colnar.
Yeah. And then later letting them go and telling them that they better not move a muscle. They better not do anything. They better not organize. There are instances of National Guards firing into tent colonies. There are instances of them invading the residents' tents and, like, holding up their children by their ankles and just generally intimidating them.
Yeah, that's something important to remember when we're talking about these tent colonies is these aren't just striking miners that are there. It's their whole, all their families, too.
It's all their families, yeah.
So
yeah, because they were forced to live in these towns.
Right.
Yeah.
So these aren't just strikers. It's strikers and their families that are being shot at and killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read one account
and arrested for no reason.
When the National Guard was intimidating him, he asked them if martial law had been declared. And they responded with, "No, martial law hasn't been declared, but it has been declared in your house." Which is just horrifying. Like, imagine, like, the kind of, like, vulnerability that you would be feeling in such a situation like that. Which was why the UMWA was giving the miners guns. Because they kind of had to. Like, they were being shot at.
I mean, imagine if the police knocked on your door, right? You open the door, and you ask for a warrant, and the police officer pulls out their gun and says, "Here's my warrant," and then pushes past you into the house.
Exactly.
Right.
And then arrests your whole family.
Right. Exactly,
That's effectively what we're talking about right now. That's what was going on. That's literally what they were doing and will, to this day, absolutely do.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, just some more, like, information about this. The National Guard was overwhelmingly white. They were dealing with a lot of Eastern European and, like, Italians, who at the time were not considered white, and a lot of Greeks as well. That's kind of just, like, the racial makeup of the miners. It was a lot of Croats, it was a lot of Greeks, and it was a lot of Italians.
And actually, I think that might be another reason why we don't talk about this, is part of the whole whitewashing of history in general, where... It doesn't serve the ruling class's purpose to have people understanding that white is a social construct. Like, what is white?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Whiteness. Oh, yeah. And it is something that has changed throughout time.
Oh, yeah. If you ever want to give an Italian father something to think about, tell them that they're not white. Like, and just see what happens.
I'll have to do that with Irish people here over in Boston. You have the Italians in New York.
Yeah. But yeah, like, the National Guard was basically taking anybody who they could get. Like, one National Guard member was 65, although the age cap for participation was 45, and another had two missing fingers. So you could tell that they were getting pretty desperate. But yeah, eventually the UMWA officials kind of realized that the strike was a losing battle, or at least that's what they thought. So by the early spring of 1914, the mine operators were getting all the non-union workers they needed. and the strike had cost the UMWA $473,876. And the UMWA's leadership was expressing serious concerns about their ability to continue financial support for the strike. So, overall, things just weren't looking good. And now we get to the actual massacre. This is the point in the show where, like, I would like to remind everybody that if you have issues with depictions of death and burning bodies and just cruelty on the part of the National Guard, you should probably skip to another part of the episode, and we'll give you that timestamp for when this part is over.
Content ends at 1 hour, 28 minutes, 50 seconds.
Okay, so coming from the same document that Mason was just touching on, The Road to Ludlow by De Stefanis, Andrew Kolnar was a Croatian immigrant and a striking miner who was arrested by the National Guard. The Guard was called out after approximately 9,000 miners went on strike in September of 1913. Many of the miners were, like Mason said, European immigrants. There were some Mexicans and Hispanics. And one duty of the Guard was to transport and protect scabs that were being imported into the strike zone. And a lot of these scabs were immigrants and were not aware that they were being brought in as strike breakers. They thought it was just a job opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Kolnar himself was arrested because he wrote a letter to a fellow Croatian immigrant who happened to be one of the scabs that was called in, who had expressed his desire previously to join the United Mine Workers, and Kolnar was encouraging this. He testified that the guardsmen arrested him, tied his hands behind his back, threw him in jail, and kept him awake all night at gunpoint. And the following morning, one Captain Drake would interrogate Kolnar to determine where the letter came from, and Kolnar took responsibility for it right away. Admitting to this awarded Kolnar with 2 more days and 2 more nights in a cell, which he described as damp, dark, cold, and awfully dirty. On the third morning of his incarceration, he was brought to an encampment with a handful of tools and told to dig a ditch, like the novel Holes. I mean, it's the same thing. Like, he was told to dig a man-sized hole, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
After inquiring to the guardsmen around him why he was digging, they heavily implied that he was digging his own grave. And upon this realization, Kolnar began to dig slower, and the guards then grabbed him, propped him up against a wall, and pretended they were going to use him as target practice before putting him back in the hole and making him keep digging.
Jeez.
Sometime later, a doctor for the guards came by to inspect that the hole was of a suitable size. He determined that it was, and made a show of discussing with the guards whether Kolnar should be buried in blankets or in a coffin. After a few more hours, Kolnar was let go and told to stay at home for 5 days or he'd be arrested again. He was warned not to act out of line, not to write any more pro-union letters, and Kolnar claimed that he would sooner kill himself than do any of that. Captain Drake responded with a threat, saying that Kolnar wouldn't have to kill himself because Captain Drake would do it for him. And that's the end of the story of Andrew Kolnar.
We have to consider, this isn't someone who was guilty of any crime. They weren't in a combat situation. They weren't in... There was... no other factors involved here where anyone could point to and be like, oh, well, maybe this might, you know, it doesn't excuse their behavior.
He wrote a letter.
Right. It doesn't excuse their behavior, but we can at least understand why they were behaving that way. No, they were getting...
No, there's none of that.
They were getting this harsh with someone. They were frankly, that's a type of torture. They were psychologically torturing this person.
Yeah.
Because they were on strike. And they tried to send a letter to somebody else, encouraging them to join the union.
That was someone else who already had expressed interest in joining the union.
Right.
So it's not even like he was trying to rob, their non-unionized workers. This person had expressed interest.
Yeah, this was somebody that had already expressed interest to him. So he's not even, like, out there trying to drum up support amongst the scabs. This is just somebody reaching out to him and him responding.
Yeah.
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 But even if that had been the case, it's none of it would have justified this, you know?
Well, of course not.
Yeah, I think I'd just like to say that, something that gets glossed over when we look at history is the psychological effect that these sorts of things have on people. The psychological effect that has on the people who know that person. Like, forget for a second, like, putting yourself in the shoes of Edward Kolnar. And put yourself in the shoes of one of his family members. Imagine how terrified and, like, concerned you would be if he just disappeared for a bunch of days and he came back and told you that the National Guard had tortured him and forced him to dig his own grave. Like, I would be enraged.
And every time that family member, every time they were late coming home from that day on.
Yeah.
It would probably start this whirlwind of panic in their minds. You know, that's what PTSD does to people.
Exactly. Yeah. So much trauma, really. But yeah, I think now that we've covered the context and how the National Guard was formed and how a lot of private detectives and company guards were reabsorbed into the National Guard, it's time to talk about the actual massacre. So at this time, the adjutant general of the National Guard, John Chase, did not have martial law, but he had full jurisdiction over Colorado, specifically Ludlow. And he used that to carry out a massacre. In 1914, Louis Tika, who was one of the strike organizers, met with the National Guard leader, Patrick J. Hamrock. While this was going on, two militias installed a machine gun on a hill and took positions along the railroad half a mile south of Ludlow. The militias detonated dynamite to draw support from the National Guard, which the residents of Ludlow interpreted as an attack. Tikas went back to the tent camp, and he stayed there the whole day, even after the fire had been started by National Guardsmen. A rifle butt was broken over his head, and he was shot several times. It is contested how many people died in the massacre. However, according to Julia May Courtney in her contemporaneous article Remember Ludlow for the magazine Mother Earth, a total of 55 women and children died in the massacre. According to her account, the militia fired the two largest buildings, the striker stores, and going from tent to tent, poured oil on the flimsy structures, setting fire to them. From the blazing tents rushed the women and children, only to be beaten back into the fire by the rain of bullets from the militia. The men rushed to the assistance of their families, and as they did so, they were dropped as the whirring messengers of death sped surely to the mark, into the cellars, the pits of hell under their blazing tents. Crept the women and children, less fearful of the smoke and flames than of the nameless horror of the spitting bullets. One man counted the bodies of 9 little children, taken from ashy pit, their tiny fingers burned away as they held to the edge of in their struggle to escape. Thugs in state uniform hacked at the lifeless forms, in some instances nearly cutting off heads and limbs to show their contempt for the strikers. 55 women and children perished in the fire of the Ludlow tent colony. Relief parties carrying the Red Cross flag were driven back by the gunmen, and for 24 hours the bodies lay crisping in the ashes, while rescuers vainly tried to cross the firing line. So, like I said, it's contested how many people died in the massacre. Officially, the death count is in the 20s, I believe. However, the people who were actually there at the time reported more bodies than that. And I think this discrepancy can really be attributed to the behavior of the National Guardsmen during this incident. How they were just hacking away at bodies and disfiguring people so as they were not able to be identified.
You also have to keep in mind that this was on top of the 75 people killed during the 1913 and 14 strikes that led up to the Ludlow Massacre.
Yes, absolutely.
So their death toll could be well in the hundreds by this point.
Yeah.
And remember, this is a state power. This was a state power being used as a cudgel by these capitalist owners to crush a resistance movement.
Yeah.
And in such an incredibly brutal fashion.
Yeah.
You know, like the amount of dehumanization that they must have really just, you know, from a propaganda standpoint, they must have dehumanized these people as much as they could for it sickens me to think about.
Yeah. So yeah, the aftermath of the Ludlow Massacre is unspectacular. Miners were arrested, courts were set up, and people were sent to prison. And the only real lasting legacy that it left behind was public opinion started to turn against John D. Rockefeller. Since he owned such a huge stake in the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, he was largely implicated in the massacre, so public opinion started turning against him. Even at the time, regardless of...
He was rich enough to afford large cows.
He was.
Sorry. I just felt like we needed to lighten things up a little bit after
that. With, like, the most terrible joke you can imagine, you know?
That's yeah, sorry, Mason.
That's okay. But yeah, anyways, fuck John D. Rockefeller. I hate that piece of
fuck
shit.
Fuck John D. Rockefeller. Seriously.
Yeah, fuck all the Rockefellers.
Fuck actually. All the Rockefellers.
So, after the occurrence of the Ludlow Massacre, news of the event had reached other tent colonies. And their response to this was a decentralized expedition throughout southern and central Colorado, which came to be known as the 10 Days War. The Union made an official call to arms, which led to widespread conflict across the southern Colorado coal fields, including clashes with the National Guard and local militias or deputies, like we've seen before. The popular opinion that people held towards the miners shifted towards the miners, actually. Previous newspaper articles that were more on the side of the companies, their opinions started to shift towards the miners as well. Some of the strikers would look for revenge against the non-striking miners and attack the Southwestern Mine Co.'s Empire Mine on April 22nd. For 21 hours, they laid siege to the mine. Strike breakers there, in defense of the mine, killed two of the strikers. And a minister from Aguilar, which was a nearby town, would hear the fighting and was afraid that the strikers intended to kill everybody in the Empire Mine. So he and the mayor would talk out a ceasefire with a union organizer, and eventually the strikers withdrew. The prominent national news outlets would actually report falsely that there were families trapped in the mines, which they weren't trapped, they were hiding there from the gunfire, and they would report that the entrances collapsed and suffocated the families inside. It was not true.
Hmm.
Yeah, funny how that works.
Yeah, it's interesting how that sort of story manages to find its way into the newspapers, but all of the actual people that the state murdered.
Yeah.
Somehow nobody seems to remember that.
Yeah, or the death counts were vastly lowered.
Right. Yeah. You get kind of this, you get this very, biased look at history where it's portrayed as like, oh, you know, the Union miners went too far. Like, the UMWA was, like, arming their miners for the purpose of, like, doing warfare. And it's just like, no, they were fighting back against a state-backed terror campaign.
Yeah, I mean, their original goal was just to stop working and shut the mines down.
Yeah.
Right.
So, in the town of Delagua, where the strikers made 4 attempts to take over the town, they ended up killing 3 of the private mine guards, and they killed another one in the town of Tabasco, which is one of the worst hot sauces, in my opinion. Hot take.
I like sriracha.
I like sriracha, too. Sriracha's
pretty good.
I like both.
Tabasco's fine, but I'd rather have a Texas Pete for that kind of flavor.
That's fair.
But anyway.
I like a good garlic chili sauce. That's always good.
Ooh, I have the Cholula garlic chili is my favorite.
So good.
This is our capitalist indulgence.
Yeah.
With our fat checks from this podcast, we're going to buy out hot sauce.
Oh, yeah. Taking all that, my Soros bucks.
Yeah. So, after the events at Delagua and Tabasco, the sheriff of Las Animas County sent a telegram to Ammons, who was the governor, stating that the sheriff and his deputies had been defeated by the miners, and they were going to request federal aid.
Mm.
So by evening of the 22nd of the same month, Lieutenant Governor Fitzgerald attempted to secure a ceasefire through the United Mine Workers' Denver-based lawyer, who went by the name of Horace Hawkins. On the next day, the 23rd, John McLennan, who was the president of the United Mine Workers District 15, was arrested by a militia at the Ludlow train stop while he was on his way from Denver to Trinidad. Hawkins agreed on a ceasefire as long as McLennan would be released, which he was. And then at midnight on April 22nd, National Guardsmen were called to head for the strike zone. General Chase claimed prior to Ludlow, he could muster 600 troops at a moment's notice, yet in this event, he could only muster 362. So that's kind of embarrassing.
Hmm.
And actually, 76 soldiers of Troop C under his command, nicknamed the Chase Troop, because 2 of the general's sons and some of his other family members were a part of it, mutinied because of uncomfortable conditions and low pay. They did not return for the rest of the conflict. So it's kind of ironic that the National Guard troops were mutinying because their pay was low and their conditions were bad.
The strikebreakers go on strike.
Literary parallels here.
It's almost like we're all working class.
Yeah. It's like what the fuck's his name? The director of Star Wars.
George Lucas.
It's like George Lucas said, Star Wars rhymes.
Yeah, it's like poetry.
It's all rhymes.
It rhymes.
Yeah, it's like poetry. Yeah.
It's like poetry. It rhymes. It's going to be great.
So, continuing on here, 2 76mm field guns and 220 rounds of shrapnel ammunition were brought in alongside the 242 soldiers that were leaving south of Denver.
Wait,
that's like
empty.
I just thought of a good joke. Izzy, can you repeat the "it's gonna be great" thing again? Because that was good.
It's gonna be great.
Us talking about this podcast.
Wait, what?
Us talking about this podcast.
yeah. You know, maybe someday we can sell it to Disney.
Yeah.
Who has a company town, by the way.
Oh, I know I knew that they were breaking into, like, the real estate market.
They basically own one of the towns in that area of Florida.
Wow, horrible.
Oh, yeah, Disney. Yeah. Disney is basically its own, like, jurisdiction.
Yeah.
That's so bizarre.
It's really weird. Like, I remember as a kid, like, this is so cool. And then you start to think about it.
The happiest place on Earth.
Mm-hmm. They have a luxury township for wealthy people to live in, and it's like for the fucking bourgeois Disney adults, because these homes are like millions of dollars, but they're decked out in like little Mickey Mouse decor and shit. Like the handrails have little Mickey Mouses.
I've seen that one. Yeah.
they're literally horrifying. Given crossbows to just shoot at like less lower income people from their balconies, just
they shoot the Disney goers who have to take the tram into Disney.
Their arrowheads have little Mickey Mouse ears on them.
Yeah,
you know what though, I guarantee you that there's going to be something like, we're going to start seeing stuff like that. We're going to let you do something that makes your life slightly less miserable, but we're going to make that slightly more miserable for the entertainment of rich people.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely see them, like, they're not going to, like, shoot you with crossbows, but,
Wait, hold on. You just described game shows.
Yeah, but, like, it's going to be just taking the train to school or to work or whatever, you know? Like,
yeah.
Every time you do something, it's like, hey, if you... If you're willing to be subjected to this, you know, whatever minor torment for someone else's entertainment, you can ride for free.
Yeah.
You know? And then if mm-hmm. you don't want to do that, well, now you pay $10 a train ride.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying.
That's too real.
I'm just saying, I can see something like that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can too. I mean, I really do think that's only a step away from what game shows already do.
Right, right.
Like, hey, win $1 million if you embarrass yourself on national television.
Right, exactly.
And oftentimes you don't even really get to win $1 million because there's a competition and, a bunch of people just go home with nothing.
Right. Also, can we just discuss for a second the fact that they brought out 76mm field guns to a labor strike?
Yeah, no, the workers did not have fucking tanks.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, these were not anti-personnel weapons. These were, like, artillery.
Yeah.
But yeah, they actually attached empty cars to the front of the train, so if there were any dynamite traps on the tracks, the empty cars would blow up rather than the cars carrying the soldiers. Because apparently the strikers would set up traps along the tracks.
Based.
A group of pro-strikers managed to deliver munitions to the strikers before the troops would arrive. Also based.
Yes. And anybody whose butthole might be puckering right now over that shit, remember, we just discussed the fact that they're dealing with people who brought artillery out.
Yeah.
Against them.
Yeah. They're dealing with the whole ass National Guard. At that point, guerrilla tactics
are warranted.
Yeah. Like, this, the context of the 10 Days War was a massacre, and the context of that massacre was a terror campaign by the mine operators backed by the National Guard. So, like, at this point, like, the miners have just had enough, and they're going to fight back using the same means that the coal operators have been using this entire time. Most strikes stay peaceful for a while until people are just pushed too far and they decide to start fighting back.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing started just because they wanted better pay and better working conditions. It didn't have to escalate this far.
No, absolutely not.
Right, yeah. Every step of the way, it's not the strikers that are driving it to this level. The strikers are responding to the escalation of the bosses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, April 25th, the Chandler mine was fired upon, which breached the truce that was signed previously. There was a truce between the state government, I believe, and the union, and the National Guard themselves breached the truce at the Chandler mine.
Jeez.
Yeah. And then 1,000 strikers launched an assault on the town that the mine was in, and they captured it the next day. A non-striking miner and one mine guard were seriously injured. The majority of Walsenburg's civilians fled, and the city was engulfed in sporadic fighting. Striking Greek miners were dissatisfied with the perceived lack of response from their union at Ludlow, so they organized their own guerrilla attacks, separate from the union, in the town of Walsenburg, and they managed to get 300 strikers together to attack the McNally mine, killing one person.
Wow.
Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, the Greek miners, they just felt like the union didn't do enough in response to what happened at Ludlow. Yeah.
Well, like I said before, the union was kind of ready to just be done with the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, by the spring of 1914, they were pretty much out of money.
Also, I think it's worth pointing out that the unions were some of the earlier attempts. Like, there's a really bad history with the unions in the United States when it comes to racial discrimination.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of instances like this as well, where we do see it being this force that's truly like multi-ethnic, multicultural, multiracial.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, you know, the Greek strikers, like they had a grievance, but it wasn't enough to drive them completely out of the union. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, their grievance was that the union didn't go far enough.
Right.
They were still on the side of the union.
Right.
So as the truce was broken and both sides would resume hostilities, they both increased their military operations. And the union and the militia, or the National Guard, both began publishing reports, reporting casualties while diminishing the claimed successes of their opponents. So basically a propaganda campaign. Over 1,000 members of the Women's Peace Association participated in a sit-in at the Capitol building on April 25th, which will be relevant in a second here. Ammons, who was exhausted of the whole ordeal, sent a request for federal troops on top of the National Guard to Woodrow Wilson, the president at the time, if there are those of you who don't know that. And then on April 26th, there was a rally that was attended by 5,000 to 6,000 protesters and Colorado Senator Charles Thomas. They stood in front of the Capitol, despite the police presence and the inclement weather in the form of heavy rain. And this, combined with the sit-in of the Women's Peace Association, completely shut down operations in the Capitol of Colorado, by the way. A few miners and George Creel, who was, I believe, an ex-cop and on the side of the striking workers, made speeches that the crowd sat and peacefully listened to. This crowd of 6,000 people sat and peacefully listened to these people talk. So it's not like they were, you know, rioting in the streets of the Capitol here. Mm-hmm. One of the demands that they listed was the impeachment of Ammons. Then on April 28th, the northernmost battle of the 10-day war happened at the Hecla Mine in Louisville, which was owned by the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company. And the company hired Baldwin Feltz to help protect its property situated between Denver and Boulder, Colorado. Yeah,
and just something that I forgot to mention earlier that I'd like to mention. By this time, the National Guard had confiscated most of the miners' guns. However, Baldwin Feltz and the other company guards got to keep their guns. So it wasn't a particularly like even matchup.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear why these strikers were stealing guns.
Yeah.
So, we're moving into the Battle of Walsenburg here, where Colonel Edward Verdickberg of the National Guard had stationed troops in Trinidad during the funeral for, how did you pronounce his name? Tychus? Tychus? The funeral for Louis Tychus, because he thought that it might be a good impetus for the National Guard to retake the town.
Mm-hmm.
Trinidad was under control of the strikers and being used as their command hub, and Verdickberg thought that the funeral would spark riots and allow him to send troops in without necessarily breaking the truce, which they had already broken, mind you.
Yeah,
right.
But he thought that would be, you know, the riots would be a good reason to send the troops in. Word was received that hundreds of strikers were attacking the CF and I McNally Mine near Walsenburg. General Chase ordered Verdickberg to take 60 of his men there in order to retake the town on the following morning of the 29th. Mine guards from the McNally, Walson, and Robinson mines, as well as the National Guard, fought strikers for control of the town. Two strikers were killed on the 28th, one by friendly fire. Several guardsmen were injured, and even fewer were killed. And at 5 p.m., an unarmed pro-Union motorcyclist, Henry Lloyd, was accidentally killed by the strikers because they mistook him for somebody else.
I support this killing. Fuck motorcyclists.
Whoa.
I'm joking.
No.
This podcast is on the record as being pro-motorcyclist murder.
No, we are okay. Anti-motorcycle. Or no. There will be a split of the fucking party.
I'm buying a motorcycle.
We're splitting the party. We're splitting this fucking podcast.
I'm a Marxist-Leninist motorcyclist. Okay, so after this first battle here, or second battle, I guess, the public opinion against the miners would start to take a negative downturn because the newspapers were making up lies about them, including reporting about battles that never actually took place.
Jeez.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah. Like, that, that's one of the reasons why, like, it's so hard to, like, know for sure what is going on, like, in any instance anywhere, because the media just lies all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's becoming increasingly harder to parse through it, too, and I imagine it was even harder back then.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
I mean, how are you going to investigate this?
Right. Go to your local library, where they have none of the books on this stuff.
Where they have the newspapers that reported the false information.
Right. Read the false news reports on microfiche.
Yeah, and you go there yourself, and then the National Guard shoots you. So
yeah.
And yeah, moving forward from this takes us into the Battle of Forbes, which happened on April 30th. After Wurtemberg moved to Walsenburg, funny sentence there, a group of 100 strikers moved from Trinidad the evening of April 30th. They met up with anti-militia forces, and the militia being the National Guard, to a strength of around 300 people. At 5 a.m., wait, shouldn't that be April 31st? Is there an April 31st?
Is there?
I don't know.
Evening of April, 5 a.m. That probably should be April 31st. That would have, it just makes
no, there sense. Is no April 31st, no. So I think the other one should be April 29th. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
wanna take that one again?
I'm just gonna make up a day here. Yeah. I'm gonna make up a day. I'm gonna make up April 31st. Now. So after Wurtemberg's move to Walsenburg, a group of 100 strikers moved from Trinidad on the evening of April 29th. They met up with an anti-militia force. That force being the anti-militia force being like anti-National Guard of around 300 total. And at 5 p.m. on April 30th, 5 a.m. on April 30th, I apologize for
there
that.
There you go.
They attacked the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company mine at Forbes, shooting into the camp and setting buildings on fire.
Jeez.
And now the force defending against this was 18 non-union men with a single emplaced machine gun. So it wasn't looking good for them. The superintendent of Forbes called for militia forces, the National Guard, to be sent from Ludlow. Ammons and Chase refused to send troops as they believed the assault on Forbes was just a feint to thin out the guardsmen. The machine gun that the non-striking miners were using ended up jamming, which allowed the attacking striker group to move in and burn the remaining majority of the structures down. The attackers were accused of threatening to dynamite the mine entrance, where uninvolved people were taking cover, though nobody in the cave actually ended up killed. The fighting was over after about 5 hours, around 10 a.m., which was only a few hours before the feds arrived. 9 people from the Forbes camp were killed, including 4 Japanese strikebreakers, who were presumably also brought in without knowing that they were strikebreakers, so they kind of got, you know, it's unfortunate that had to happen. I guess not that it had to happen, but that it did happen. And at least 3 strikers were killed by the defending force. And this brings us to the conclusion of the 10 Days War. John D. Rockefeller Jr., which again, just to remind you, fuck him,
yep.
Refused Wilson's offer, Wilson being the president, of mediation, in which Wilson offered the condition of collective bargaining rights for the strikers. So Rockefeller refused that. He didn't want the strikers to have collective bargaining rights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool guy, cool, huh? Dude. Wilson exerted pressure on Ammons and other state officials while threatening to deploy federal troops to the area. And this was a risky maneuver because the Mexican Revolution was already taking up some of the federal resources because the U.S. was interfering in the Mexican Revolution for a reason I'll leave you to guess. April 28th, Wilson ordered the Department of War to move units to Colorado while preparing to federalize Colorado's National Guard. Imagine wanting to federalize this group that's been harassing workers for some 20 years now. Not 20 years at this point, 10 years?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, insane. Wilson invoked the Insurrection Act of 1807, and this was the first time since 1894, and only the 9th time ever up to that point that this would be enacted, or acted upon, rather. And a total of 1,590 enlisted soldiers and 61 officers would be deployed to Colorado. The Secretary of War, Lindley Garrison, stated his goal was for the federal troops to preserve an impartial attitude, which is kind of a crock of shit if you put any sort of thought into this at all.
Yeah. Right.
They obviously weren't impartial.
Yeah, they were clearly on the side of the mine operators.
Yeah, I mean, they even went to federalize the National Guard. They're all just on the same side at this point. I mean, Wilson was sort of sympathetic, but he, instead of pushing back against Rockefeller, he was like, okay,
yeah. You
don't want them to have the you know, collective bargaining rights? That's fine. I'll just send in the troops instead.
Right.
Yeah.
So after this intervention of the feds and a disarmament campaign, the 10 Days War would end. On April 29th, Lawson would order the remaining miners to stand down. On May 2nd, Garrison would issue a proclamation stating that all persons not in military service of the United States were to disarm. And then, despite this, only the strikers ended up disarming because Ammons made assurances that the militia was withdrawing and they didn't need to relinquish their weapons because they were withdrawing.
Nah.
And in total, 54 more people were killed in all of this post-Ludlow violence. So we're at close to 200 body count for all this.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't even...
we haven't even hit West Virginia yet.
Yeah, that's going to be a time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think now we should start wrapping up the episode and just give our kind of final thoughts on this whole thing.
So this is going to be just one part of this situation. There are more events that happened in West Virginia, and we only have time to cover Colorado today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just going to, you know, wrap up here, give some quick thoughts, and we'll see you guys next time.
Yeah. I can only handle reading about this stuff in small doses, so doing the research for this episode was kind of difficult for me. I remember one day, actually, I broke down crying reading the account of the Ludlow Massacre that I read earlier on the episode. And if there's one takeaway from this episode that I hope you walk away with, it's that A, people with a lot of power who are hired for the purposes of oppressing the masses can be very cruel and very terrible. But B, I would also really like people to recognize the patterns that we are outlining here, or at least what we've tried to outline. Because, like, in the case of the Ludlow Massacre, and probably even in the case of the Colorado Coalfield Wars, you had a lot of collusion between government and the coal operators. It was a little bit different with the Colorado Coalfield Wars, because the governor at the time was sympathetic to the strikers, but he would be the last governor of Colorado who would be like that, at least not for a long time. And what we saw was, like, just private ownership of public officials. The coal operators got to basically pick who the general of the National Guard would be. They staffed their state military board with members of the National Guard. Or the state military board with operatives from the coal company, I mean. And I think that it's good to keep in mind that a liberal democracy is the perfect shell for capitalism, and once capitalism has its hooks in that liberal democracy, it is very hard to get them out.
I couldn't agree more. I would just like to remind everybody that we tried to be comprehensive with this, but obviously there's limitations to what we can achieve in a podcast format.
Yeah.
And I'm going to encourage everyone to go and take a look in the show notes at all of our sources that we're going to post there. Mm-hmm. And read through the materials yourself. It's right there. This is a really, like, dark chapter in our history that is almost completely forgotten. And I think now when we see things are getting pretty bad out there, economically speaking, we're going to be hitting some really hard times coming up. We're already in hard times.
Yeah.
And there's lessons to be learned from this stuff.
Yeah.
And I hope that everyone takes something away from it.
Yeah. In a sense, we haven't evolved very far past the idea of the company town. in a lot of places, certain elements of industry are central to people's lives. And think about it like this. Like, you work a job, regardless of what your job is, you work a job, you're selling your labor for a wage. And that wage is supposed to meet your needs, and maybe a little extra if you're lucky. But essentially, after getting your wage, you have to go around and you have to give that money to your landlord. You gotta give it to the grocery store. You gotta give it to the clothing store. You have to give it to these large multinational corporations, which exist to make a profit off of you. So you're selling your labor for a wage, and at the end of the day, all you're getting is the bare things that you need to secure your existence.
I mean, there's a reason that this stuff has sort of been lost to the annals of history.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be able to have this sort of power again.
Yeah.
And
honestly, they're kind of succeeding.
Right. That's the direction that we're moving in, and we have been for a while. Capitalism is always going to be trying to adjust back to that status of the company town.
Yeah. It might look a little bit differently. Instead of having corporate paternalism, we might have corporate maternalism now, where, like, in the case of these, like, tech companies, like, some of your needs are being met. But at the end of the day, like, the value that you produce with your work is still being stolen from you.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that was a pretty good episode. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on this, and we will see you next time when we cover more of the Cold Wars.
Yep. Bye, everybody.